Howdy. First, I want to give a big shout out to the organizers for accommodating my schedule. I was originally going to be on. Wait a minute. Hold on, you. Slideshow. From beginning. There we go. So I was originally going to present on Thursday. However, Friday is my 10-year wedding anniversary, and I really want to make it to 11. So I'm leaving Thursday morning. I know, I should cry a little tear. And so that's why I'm here now. But I note that I got the highly coveted just before lunch slot, so touche. So yeah, what I'm going to talk about quickly is stuff that I did last year with my student Aidan Draper, who graduated last year, and the results were published in ABJ. And if you want the details, please go back there, because I won't be able to go through them all. There's also a sequel that was published in ABJ Letters, where we apply what I'm going to talk about to ULERG. So if you're so inclined, you can look at that one too. So the idea here is, how do you fuel AGNs, and are there more than one way of doing it, and is there any evidence for there being more than one way? So briefly, sort of the fueling modes fall into two generic categories. The first is merger-triggered AGNs, which are, it's an old idea, been around a while, it's very simple. In order to fuel an AGN, especially a bright quasar, you need to dump a large amount of material very quickly onto the central supermassive black hole. A nice way of doing this is to take two gas-rich galaxies, slam them together, there's big torques, dumps a lot of gas down towards the center. You get a lot of star formation as well, potentially obscuring the AGN, which we also need lots of. And then maybe in modern times, we think a lot about feedback. That feedback blows out the star-forming gas. You shine brightly as a quasar, and then it all fades down to a nice glorious demise as an elliptical galaxy. And we've seen lots of simulations over the last several years now hammering into this problem from multiple directions, basically showing that with suitable adjustment of parameters, you can basically account for almost every AGN phenomenology you want. But is this actually going on in the universe at a common rate? Observationally, it's difficult to get the causality down. We know there's interactions, but when you do interacting galaxies and a control sample, the AGN fractions in both often are not that different. So another way is I'm just going to call secular triggering, which is basically anything that's not a major merger. These can still be external triggers, so flybys or galaxy harassment can also funnel little bits of gas down towards the center. Nuclear starburst disks, stellar bars, stellar winds, anything that can remove angular momentum and send material down toward the center. Another key point about the secular mode of AGN triggering, it's unlikely to change the morphology of the host galaxy, so it makes it even more difficult to find observational evidence. So rather than going around and looking at individual objects, it might be interesting to look at populations of AGNs to sort of see if there's evidence for these different modes of triggering coming out. And because we have now, in this era of deep surveys, multi-wavelength surveys, we have big catalogs of AGNs from the local times down to high redshifts. And is there evidence for two populations of AGN triggering? And of course, stepping back a bit, since we know that the growth of AGNs and then supermassive black holes is connected to galaxy formation and evolution, different modes of AGN triggering indicate different modes of galaxy evolution. So this is important even on a broader sense. So one of the results of these surveys is the evolution of AGNs. And I'm going to show the hard X-ray luminosity function. This is just one recent permutation of that. And basically, it shows strong evidence for cosmic downsizing of AGNs. As you go back to higher redshifts, the density of AGN drops, but the peak luminosity moves to larger times, obviously more quasars at higher redshifts than there are now. An interesting point to remember, when there's a huge cottage industry to follow up these guys and look at their redshifts and luminosities and stellar properties and so on. An interesting thing to remember is back when Chandra was launched and we were starting this out, is that we expected the X-ray background to be obscured quasars at redshifts of 2 to 3. However, they're obscured Seyfert galaxies at redshifts less than about 1. So this is indicating perhaps the two populations or two modes of AGNs. We have the mostly unobscured quasars. Now, of course, there's obscured ones, but they're not as numerous as the obscured Seyferts that make up the X-ray background. So are these obscured Seyferts, which generate the X-ray background, are they indicating a different mode of AGN and therefore galaxy assembly and evolution? Or is it just this fading quasars regime from redshifts 2 to 3? So how can we go and test that? So that's what we did last year. We constructed two populations of AGNs. First, we're going to consider the space density of major mergers of gas-rich galaxies. And we're going to take the sort of null hypothesis view where every gas-rich major merger produces an AGN, every single one. And so the way we calculate that is multiplying three numbers together. First, the merger rate per galaxy per gigayear taken from Phil Hopkins simulations. Then the space density of massive galaxies, which is just an integral over the stellar mass function above some minimum stellar mass. And then the fraction of gas-rich galaxies as a function of redshift. And of course, there's more gas-rich galaxies at higher redshift than there is now. And that gives us a merger rate per galaxy, merger rate density, sorry. And of course, every major gas-rich merger creates an AGN. And we're going to populate, we're going to make an AGN for all of those and then fit it to data and see if we can actually account for all the observed AGNs with that. If we can't, if there's stuff left over, then we'll call it the secular guys. And that's also three numbers. The last two are the same. And then there's a free parameter out in front, which is the fractional rate of AGNs triggered secularly per gigayear. One other ingredient we need is AGNs, of course, aren't just on-off. They follow a light curve. We're going to assume the same light curve for both the merger-triggered and the secular-triggered. It looks like this. Comes from Hopkins and Hernquist. Three free parameters, which we vary to when we fit the data, although the results actually don't depend greatly on that. We don't assume that, although we assume they both follow the same shape, rise and fall, we can allow for the fact that mergers may last, may be peakier and seculars may last longer, so we don't assume necessarily that they're identical, only they go up and down. All right, nearly there. So, and to calculate actually luminosities and compare to actual data, yes, I actually create models and fit them to data. It's probably the first time you've seen that today. Sorry, that was mean. So we're going to consider, we have to have a black hole mass function and we're going to evolve it. We're going to consider two different black hole mass functions. One is observationally derived by Netzer. It's redshift 0.15 taken from a nice selection of Sloan AGNs, and it's sort of log normal. And then we also use the Merlonian-Hines Schechter black hole mass function for locally. And then we're going to evolve them with redshift two different ways. One is just assume continuity, and the other is one more observationally derived measurement, which is actually more rapid evolution. This is from Lobita et al. And they looked at quasar mass functions up at higher redshift, and they noted that the maximum black hole mass evolved very quickly. And so we're going to consider those cases as well. And finally, we use the bolometric correction marked by Marconi to get the X-ray luminosity. And to actually try to figure out what all of these situations best describes the data, we compare it to the hard X-ray luminosity function, the X-ray background, the black hole mass density, and X-ray number counts in order to focus in on hopefully what's the best thing. Now, I don't have time to show you all the different scenarios, but basically, if we try to fit the data with one population, either merger or secular, it doesn't work. Something breaks. So we have to we do need to go to the two populations. And that's what's shown here. So this is the hard X-ray luminosity functions in four redshift bins. All the data points are taken from various different measurements. There's three lines in each panel. The black line is the total hard X-ray luminosity function. And then, more importantly, there's a red line, which is the contribution from mergers. And you can see that, sort of as expected, it sort of dominates up a high redshift. Basically, the entire hard X-ray luminosity function is produced by merger-triggered AGNs. And then the blue line is the secular-triggered. And it starts coming into play right around redshift 1 or so. In fact, right there, there's sort of an equal contribution from both. And then once you get below redshift of 1, the seculars start having, you need the seculars to dominate. And the fading quasars are actually all at low luminosities. And of course, locally, it's almost all secular. And if we look at the merger fraction locally, it's around 20%, which is incidentally what the BAT sample seems to find. Another interesting result is the secular triggered AGNs are best described by the Netzer black hole mass function evolving slowly with continuity. But the quasar regime seems to be best described by the Merlonian-Hines black hole mass function, which has a higher mean mass and evolves much more rapidly. So again, an indicating sort of two separate growth modes of AGN. In terms of the mass and the light, the black hole mass density, black and red lines basically lie on top of each other. So as we know, the black hole mass density is grown through luminous accretion triggered by major mergers in the quasar era, i.e. the Soltan argument. However, interestingly, the integrated accretion light, which makes up the X-ray background, is dominated by the secularly triggered AGNs. And that's because there's a lot of them, and they're nearby. The quasars are really luminous, but there's not that many, and they're far away. So the X-ray background is produced by these nearby secularly triggered AGNs. But the mass has grown in the quasar era. Lastly, up here is the space density of AGNs and the luminosity density of AGNs in three different luminosity bins. They all basically have the same thing, which is there's a transition from merger-triggered AGN to secularly-triggered AGN at around a redshift of 1 to 1.5. Now, this is a really interesting time in the history of the universe. This is where you get the last gasp peak of star formation before it starts falling off and the gas fractions start plummeting. It's also the same period where lambda starts kicking in and the universe starts accelerating. So there seems to be a change in the way that AGNs, and therefore galaxies, are grown and interacting that happens between 1 and 1.5. And I think it's an interesting question to look at why this might be happening. And I'll end there. Thank you.
Are you assuming the same radiative efficiencies for the merger trigger and secular trigger activity? And because I wonder if so, to which extent could that be degenerate with, say, your, what do you infer for the mass function? Or?
I believe we are using the same radiative efficiency. I think given the weakness of its results on the light curve, that is probably wouldn't make much of a difference. But I don't think we actually tested that.
Can you go back to the luminosity functions?
Yeah,
this one. So if I get it right, basically at redshift about 0.6 or so, merger trigger AGNs dominate by number from your luminosity function. Basically, the red line is above the blue line.
At redshift 0.6?
And above. It's about equal there, and then it keeps
going. Well, the blue line, I'm tracing it right now, is rare, so they match sort of around the knee, but there's, and it goes down there. But
as you go higher, then at redshift one it's equal, and then at redshift two are many more mergers.
Yeah.
The problem is that if you look at something like the Chandra Eiffel South, and if you look at the morphologies there, and there have been a series of papers on that, like Kochevsky, Kevin's,
I'll stop you Brooke, right there, because I am going to agree with you.
Well, but that's a problem. They're all secular AGN. I mean, they're AGN. No. If you take, for example, like Kevin's result, you take the CERCIC index of the AGN host galaxies, if you compare it to normal galaxies, you get pretty much the same distribution.
No, but that's not what David's saying. What David's saying is that the AGN are triggered by mergers, but that's not necessarily different from the field at these redshifts.
Yeah, and also I would say that I took the most merger positive point of view. I remember I'm saying that every, gas-rich major merger triggers an AGN and follows that light curve. So I agree. This is the best case scenario for mergers, and even then it falls short. So I'm not surprised that the observations are now showing that it might even be less common sort of around the low, mid to low luminosities. But it's hard to nail down observationally.
Thanks. Hi, David. I have a comment and a question. The comment is about the discussion that just happened. And I want to refer you to Brooke Simmons' thesis, where she very carefully simulated 55,000 galaxies exactly to explore the selection effects about losing surface brightness, et cetera, et cetera. And we can now correct for those effects. And we find that 3/4 of AGN host galaxies at redshift 1 and at redshift 2 have big disks that are about half the light or more. So they are not products of recent major mergers. The question is about the relative importance of these two triggering methods, which I think matches what we understand from the like Kevin's recent work on the color magnitude diagram. But basically, the quasar type objects are very rare. So in terms of galaxy evolution, most galaxies never go through that phase. So most galaxies must do this secular, more calm thing. Is that right, or is there some other issue that I'm not?
I think that's right, and that's sort of what I think that's the conclusion that your work and other groups are finding, and I think this is supporting that in order to for the very luminous quasars, maybe you do need something like major mergers, but it's probably the less common mode, and I think the nice thing about what all this is collectively saying is that while it's fantastic to model colliding galaxies in our computer and make wonderful movies, that seems to be a less common or now maybe even rare way of galaxy interactions and evolution. And so maybe we need to take a collective step back and think about other ways that galaxies can grow and evolve and AGNs get triggered to, in our understanding, because I think all of this work is showing that mergers, while fantastic laboratories, are rare and can only, at most, explain, only half the galaxy evolution that's ever occurred.
No, it's only a comment. So just to be clear, so it's true the major mergers, 1 to 3, are rare. But here, again, in secular, you're also putting minor mergers. So we have to keep this in. Minors are very frequent. So now when we always say merger trigger, I don't know, I just want to avoid the confusion. The merger trigger means secular is just bars or instabilities. Merger, it's only major merger. And those are rare and might make them most luminous ones. The secular, let's keep in mind that it's also minor mergers that are very frequent.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's a very valid point.
So it's sort of more of a comment and addressing that. If you have a galaxy that has a ring that's not a merger-triggered ring, they're very easily disrupted, and you can say that it has had essentially no interactions for the last 3 giga years. And we did a comparison of a population of basically the AGN fraction in ringed galaxies and non-ringed galaxies, and they are indistinguishable. Ms. McKern, no, not polar rings. Polar rings are caused by, this is your outer Lidmeyer resonance rings that just basically they take a very long time to build up, and they're disrupted by the, the slightest sort of minor interaction. Minor merger would absolutely do it in. And so, these are obviously, since we can see these things, these are pretty local things, but the populations, the AGN fraction of the two populations is indistinguishable. So that's McKernan.
Thank all the speakers of the session.